Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Well, you've just been listening to Samuel Barber's String Quartet. What a beautiful, soothing and calming piece of music. My name's Jerry Pives, and you're now listening to the second segment of my radio show, Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair. And in this segment, I'm going to be reflecting on some of the psychological issues that came up in the session with Glenn. Not about Glenn, but about what we can all learn and what tools we can pick up from this session. And of course, there was a lot in this session about depression. Glenn was incredibly honest about 30 odd years of depression and of his father's depression and of the treatment that his father got made him a lot worse. So I thought it might be worth reflecting a little bit on just what is depression and how do we know when we've got depression and what is it all about? If we don't understand what depression is, then we're kind of a victim to it, like it's a disease. And yet in my lifetime of working with people, I've always found that depression originates from some cause. We don't wake up one day and say, oh, I think I'll behave like a depressed person. In fact, the biggest clue to the meaning of depression is in the very word itself. Our body's systems, our mind, our spirit, our emotions, our energy, our very soul, it's as if a weight has fallen down upon us, and suddenly we're no longer free to move about as we once used to. But it's as if we're carrying a weight on our shoulders. And that's not a bad analogy. What causes a depression is a weight of some kind, something undealt with, something unprocessed. And although people can get depressed at different stages of life, the older you get, the more weight the unprocessed incidents in your life or in the life of your family get to weigh down upon us. And it's my view that it's not a medical or a medication issue, nor is it a lack of electricity to the brain, which would be the suggestion of electric shock treatment. It's not a chemical imbalance. There's absolutely no scientific evidence for depression having a different brain chemistry than an undepressed person, despite the stories that have been fed to us over decades. Now, I'm not giving medical advice here, but if you are going to seek medication, you need to ask your doctor about the side effects and the long-term effects of what you're going to be taking. There's an awful lot of information coming out now, not from me, but from all around the place, about the incredible challenges that coming off drugs is giving to people, and how the medication is almost as bad as the illness. In fact, in many cases, we're hearing stories of people who would say, I'd rather have had my depression than the trouble I've had getting off my medication. Now, I'm not a doctor, so do not take this as any form of medical advice, but as a psychotherapist, I can say that all the depressed people I've worked with and successfully helped have found that there has been something going on in their past. It's really very simple. It seems that the only people who don't want to take on such a logical, sensible, very human and easily understandable idea that we become depressed when the weight of the past and the weight of our life and what's happened to us in our life becomes too much for us to bear and we shut down. The only people who seem to be invested or to get advantage out of not believing this remarkably obvious and simple idea are the pharmaceutical industry and the people who are their pushers of their drugs. I don't think that system's going to last much longer unless the healing professions understand the simplicity of the human mind, the human soul. After all, if medication worked for depression, there'd be no need for counselors or psychotherapists. So what happens in depression? Well, it is like a weight is upon you, but in fact, all our systems begin to shut down. We now know that the brain patterns from functional MRI scans indicate with depression that there's a kind of shutting down. So the body can go into an activated sympathetic nervous system state where we get hyperactive and busy and fight and flight and hyperactive and there's energy buzzing around that we don't know what to do with. That is what is often called manic states. And then we get the depression, which is where another nervous system kicks in, the dorsal vagus system. And it's a shutdown system. And it's where we get a depressed shutdown state of the whole nervous system, including what happens to our organs, our thinking, our brain fog, our tone of voice can become very flat. Everything's even. There's no energy to make the inflections that make for alive human interaction. It's a suffering. And the research is very, very clear about this. It's trauma, it's suffering, it's pain that causes us to trigger that particular nervous system. It comes from overwhelm. When a young deer is caught by a lion and there is no possibility of escape, what happens is that deer's nervous system goes into complete shutdown. It plays dead. It literally goes into complete shutdown. And it's almost as if the organism knows that it's being overwhelmed and it needs to shut down and in some way gather its own energy from within. But there are many examples of animals escaping their predator because they just played dead. But they weren't playing dead. They had shut down. And if the predator isn't all that hungry, they want to store it for later and it wakes up and it can just go away. So we're talking about shutdown to the system. And we're talking about what causes that. And what causes shutdown is very simple. It's overload. It's overwhelm. And one of the interesting things about what we heard Glenn do was that he would go out just before the program. He went bush. And he knew he needed to get out. He needed to move and he needed to get into his own space, a processing time. For some people, that might be hunting through the night. But for others, it might be going into the tool shed or going into the shed and doing some manual work. One of the most remarkable and therapeutic activities that is good for depression is something that involves you and engages your body. You see, if the body is shutting down, then one of the things we need to do with depression is to move, physically move. This is the what I would call the band-aid side of things. We need to physically move. And this is why things like exercise are so valuable. This is why occupational therapy is so valuable. Basket weaving and various craft things. I would say that the crafty things are some of the most important of them all. They involve us actively in movement, and they involve the mind with a puzzle or a task. And while that's all going on, there is energy, and that energy is needed in order to regroup. Now, in bodywork, when I deal with a depressed system, I'm dealing with someone who's chronically ill. I'm dealing with someone who's had an immune collapse. I'm dealing with someone who has been very, very tired or exhausted or depressed for a very long time. And one of the things that works for very depressed people is actually quite vigorous massage. It's as if the system gets reawakened, not with damaging electric shock through the brain, but through safe, planned, and agreed upon vigorous touch. So you might try, if you're feeling depressed, you might try a massage because the contact with the body is very, very important. Massage is probably the most underrated of all the healing disciplines. It probably does more than most of the healing disciplines, and it's recognized the least. I know of which I speak here. I've been massaging since 1984. And of course, the touch that is given through massage reaches deeply into the body and the energy systems. Even if it's very slow, gentle touch, you should never accept any kind of touch. You should always be able to say, you know, I'd like it to be soft and gentle and non-invasive. I'd like it to be very smooth and flowing. But another time you might say, I do feel like I need a bit of an electric shock. Well, you won't get an electric shock from a massage therapist, but they do know an awful lot of vigorous moves that can just activate and bring alive the system. Someone who's stuck in the corner of a room in depression, you need to reach out your hand and say, come for a walk with me. Let's go for a walk together. Let's hoover up the room. Let's tidy the room. Let's do something exciting. Let's do something interesting. Let's go and solve this puzzle. I need you to come and help me. Many, many parents recognize the value of activating movement when children are low or down or just struggling with life in general. And we all struggle with life. We all go through moods of down. Okay. And they're not to be feared, because what's actually happening is the body is dropping into a recovery and recuperate. And this actually led me to develop a whole form of touch that was relevant for people who were so depleted, exhausted, shut down. They had gone beyond what we call freeze, which is the shutdown state, into a kind of exhaustive flop where there was no rigidity. Freeze has a sense of rigidity and locked in fear, frozen. But after a while, the tension needed to hold yourself in that locked and frozen place, you run out of energy for that if you're in this repeated state. So you drop into flop. And so it led me to develop a whole form of touch that was remarkably gentle, nothing like massage that I'd ever seen or been taught. But it was just the clients that made me think, what if we try this? And I tried it with my clients and they said it really helped them. And this was really simple. This actually looks a lot more like what you would call traditional healing, where there's a kind of a laying on of hands. And if you just imagine yourself with your hands on your thighs and you just gently lay your hands in and press in a little bit, but then come up. So there's just the weight of your hands on your leg, on your thigh. Eventually, if you just keep gently pressing in, but not too hard, and then just changing the pressure ever so slightly, what happens? You start to generate heat and vibration. And it's as if what I realized happened is with another person, a body worker, or just a friend, just ask a friend to put their hands on your back, relax their hands, and to just sit there. You can be chatting if you want, or you can just put some nice music on. And I would just sit there for 20, 30 minutes with just hands on. We wouldn't be talking, they'd be breathing. And the warmth and the heat that started to generate when one human being does what we're designed to do, which is to touch and to reach out. When we do that, it's absolutely amazing. And massage therapists who do this, if you're a massage therapist and you're listening and you've got a client that's really locked and stuck and in a very depressed way, try this. You know, yes, by all means, discuss with them whether they'd like vigorous massage. But if someone is chronically depleted and exhausted, the vigorous massage won't work. There's not enough energy to even shove around and wake them up. There's a complete depletion. And it's like a river valley where the waterbed is just a trickle. And we just need to, as it were, pour the rain down, let the water build. It's almost like we go still. We set up a little beaver dam, and then we just gently let the water build up slowly. And then it builds up, and the person walks away feeling fuller, warmer, more nurtured. And touch conveys so many. If it's safe, if you trust the person touching you, touch conveys so much deep into the nervous system that words cannot reach, that therapy cannot reach, and which I don't think drugs can even reach, to be honest. It's as if we are designed to help each other. And sometimes words will help, and sometimes it's just down to movement and touch. So you're listening to me, Jerry Pives. This is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair. And I'm reflecting on the issue of depression. And I'd like to share a personal story of my own around depression. When I was in my early 20s and I was a school teacher, I became literally overwhelmed by, well, many, many things, but a great deal of what I became overwhelmed with was the unacknowledged and unprocessed pain of my childhood and of my family's history going back many generations. I got very ill, so the somatic component, the body component, was very much like an overwhelm. It was called ME, and I couldn't really get out of bed. I mean, I could get up for breakfast, and then I had to go back to bed. I was exhausted. And then I would just get up for mealtime, and then I'd get back to bed. I would literally, I was at least eating, but I was absolutely wiped out. And of course, this ME was really just a form of depression. My systems had shut down and I was very low. I was low physically, energetically, and emotionally as well. So the ME was really hiding what was in fact a depressive episode. And interestingly, several things helped me. The first thing I did is I'd been reading Carl Jung. I'd been reading Carl Jung since I was about 17 years old. And I knew that dreams were probably very important. And I'd had a few dreams that I hadn't really understood. So I opened up a dream journal. And I was sick for about a year. And during that year, I was very fortunate to be looked after by my then girlfriend and became my future wife. Her parents are very generous parents. And so I had the space and the time. Well, I couldn't have done anything anyway. I couldn't teach. It took me right out of my teaching career. And I just started a dream journal. And during this time, the other thing I did was I found myself reading the Bible. And somehow the two things worked very well together. And so I was reading, you know, the oldest book on the planet and wondering and musing upon the stories of the Old Testament, which are all powerful, powerful stories. And I was writing down my dreams. And then I was doing my own sort of analysis. I wasn't referring to Jung, but I was just freewheeling and wondering, I wonder if that image means that to me. And I assumed that if that image came up to me or that meaning came up to me, then it was probably right. And I'd found a lot of meaning in my dreams. It also engaged me because I was writing things down. It was like a journaling. So I was writing. I like to write. So I was doing things I enjoy. I was writing. And I was kind of convalescing without any pressure to do anything or even to, I mean, I wanted to get better, but I had no idea how to do that. And I didn't really have the energy to think about it. But the other thing that was very interesting for me, and this is at the age of, you know, 26, 27, was that I became obsessed with jigsaws. Now, if you think about it, jigsaw puzzles are rather interesting. In terms of an occupational therapy, there's something you can do on your own. I set myself up on the living room table or in my bedroom and started buying and asking for people to buy me these big 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzles and found enormous pleasure and relaxation in just working out where everything goes. And if you think about a jigsaw, it's rather like a life. When we're ill, it's as if we're broken, broken into bits. It's as if we've been jiggered by the jigsaw. And so the bits, the broken up bits of a unified picture get broken up. And then I spent time putting them together. Well, this is rather beautiful because a jigsaw is an amazing way to send a calm message to yourself that you're putting it all back together again. You're recuperating, you're regrouping. And so I became obsessed with jigsaws for about, well, I think it was about 6 months. And every time I completed a jigsaw, I think I was saying to myself deep, deep down, somewhere symbolically to my unconscious, I was saying, you'll bring yourself back together again. And it was a time when after that, I actually went and managed to start my healing journey. But the body doesn't stop or get depressed for no reason whatsoever. The job is to find out what's been ignored. And I think that's why dreams are so very, very important. Because dreams, which I talked about on the last episode, dreams are one of the ways that our unconscious communicates to us that there's something we're not facing, there's something we're not dealing with. But it doesn't have to be jigsaws. It can be anything. Early on, I think I told the story from a book, and I forget which book, but the story of a psychoanalyst and his client. And the client came 3 times a week for 3 years. And after 3 years, they looked at each other and they said, this isn't really getting anywhere, is it? It wasn't working. Nothing was really helping the client. So, you know, in fairness, the analyst was courageous enough to say, I'm really sorry, you know, this isn't working. You need to go and find something else that will help you. Well, he didn't hear from this client for a couple of years. And then one day on a Saturday morning, he got a knock on his door. And there before him was this hale and hearty man with nicely filled out, great big beard, beaming at him from the street as he opened the door. And the psychoanalyst said, yes, can I help you? And the client said, don't you recognize me? And it turned out to be the client that he had failed to get anywhere with. They'd failed together to get anywhere. So he says, oh my goodness, come on in. And he invites him into his house and sits him down for a cup of coffee and says, what did you do? You look so well. Because when he was coming to see the psychoanalyst, he was pale, he was bedraggled looking, he was thin, he'd lost weight. And here was this really sun-bleached face and looking very, very healthy. And the client said, well, I wanted to come and see you because I wanted to tell you what has happened. And he said that when he realized that his life really wasn't working, that the best thing that could ever happen to him was when the analyst said to him, you know, you need to do something else. And he went home from that session and he thought about what he would like to do. And he didn't want to stay in, it was in London. He didn't want to stay in London. So he sold his house in London and went up to Norfolk and he bought himself a boat, a houseboat. Only he bought himself a dilapidated, old, broken down houseboat and he got himself a caravan. And he spent, I think it was 2, maybe 3 years, rebuilding the houseboat, rather like a jigsaw, putting everything back together again. And he said that as he took out the rotten old boards and put new boards in, and as he built that boat up, bit by bit, carefully, lovingly, artistically, he realized at some point that he was putting himself back together again. Now, if anyone out there is listening and knows which book I'm referring to, please write in and let me know if you know of this book. And what the client said is by the time the boat was finished, I felt cured. I felt healed. I kind of knew myself again, and I knew what I wanted in my life. I can't remember what it was he said, but it was as if he'd given himself permission to rebuild himself. So when our health breaks down, it's really an important message coming from our unconscious to say, oi, there's a leak in the boat. If you go out to sea in this particular boat, you're going to be in trouble. You need to do some repairs. Now, I'm sure all the boat owners will be saying, yeah, you need to do that every year. And actually, that's a very good analogy. We need to keep on top of our processes. What is going on for us deep down? And that's where a dream journal, or any kind of journal for that matter, takes a very important significance for us. And that's why going into therapy or joining a group of some kind is always going to be beneficial to your life. No one ever got sick from understanding too much about themselves. Everyone I've ever worked with got sick because there was something about themselves they needed to understand. And don't worry about it being selfish or self-indulgent. Those are the accusations made by people who are terrified to look inside themselves. Going inside, going into your past, going into what makes you tick, that is the way to live a life of freedom. And if we don't do that, we're in danger of being oppressed by the environment, by governments, by everything outside of us and the pressures upon us. And I've always felt that doing the work that I do is a revolutionary act. It's against oppression to free a human being from the restrictions of what being human is. And being human is amazing on the one hand and disastrous on the other. Have you noticed that? Anyone who walks around saying, oh, we're all good people, Well, I hope you've got blindfolds on your eyes, because look around you at what is going on in this world. And there are great people and there are good people. But humans have this horrendous capacity to drop down to the lowest common denominator. And one of the ways into the dark side of being human is not to take care of ourselves. You know, in the Bible, we talk about Adam and Eve being given stewardship of the earth, of the Garden of Eden. We're also meant, I believe, to have stewardship of the garden within ourselves, the garden of our heart, of our mind, and our instincts. And we're meant to be the stewards of that. We're meant to take care of that. So that's what I wanted to say about depression. Two things, really. Get moving, or get reparative, gentle, energy building touch, and do activities that bring you joy and calm and peace, like might be knitting, building something, whatever it is. Get involved in something that gives you pleasure and joy while you recuperate, and send a message of wholeness to your psyche, to the soul of who you are, and say, I hear you. Something's gone wrong. I need to take time and consider what's going on. And let yourself know that you're for yourself. It's not selfish to take care of yourself, just as it's not selfish to farm the ground to feed others. Who the hell do you think is going to benefit from your health? Everybody around you. Humanity depends on each other. And it's the people who won't work on themselves that are the biggest drain, the most destructive, and the most damaging to human society. So on that note, I think it's time for a little break, don't you? And time for a piece of music. And the piece I want to play is a piece that you may not have heard before, which is by Lucinda Drayton and Andy Blissett of Blissful Music. And it's called simply The Deep. And it's a piece that is profoundly spiritual, but also profoundly permission-giving to just let go, to go into the deep. Remember, the deep is the image that we have for the unconscious. And to trust that something within us all knows how to, as it were, put us back together again. So on this note of tuning in and dealing with our stuff and allowing ourselves to understand, to pause, instead of desperately trying to change everything and fix everything, to simply pause and let go and allow a deeper wisdom that is within each and every one of us, I believe, that can tell us exactly what is going on for us. But it might take time. In my case, it took me 18 months to kind of rebuild my life. And this is what I ended up doing. You've just been listening to The Deep by Blissful Music, that is Lucinda Drayton and Andy Blissett. And this is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair, and you're in the second segment where I'm reflecting upon a fantastic interview with Glenn Thurston, in which really we were talking about depression. One of the things I've been saying is that when we're depressed and we're shut down, one of the things we actually need is movement and touch and some kind of activity. And of course, what's so beautiful about Glenn's work is that that's exactly what he's suggesting to people. He's suggesting that they go on hunting trips in which they are invited to just talk about what's going on for them, but not necessarily in the intense way of sitting in a room with a therapist or even across the table with a friend, but side by side, walking outside. And by the way, If it intimidates you, the thought of having to kind of expose and bare your soul in, you know, sitting front on to a therapist, you can always ask the therapist whether they would do outdoor therapy with you, where you can go for a walk. And that gives you a private space. You know, unless someone's going to be walking a yard behind and listening in on the conversation, even if there are other people around, then going for a walk is actually remarkably private. But you also get the beauty of the nature. Some people are calling it wild therapy, but I think it's just important to sometimes be outside, and it can feel more relaxing to just chat and talk while you're moving. And there's a lot of reasons why movement, when talking about the past or issues or stuff that upsets you, movement's actually very, very good because it's somehow discharging the nervous system energy of what you're talking about. In my own work, although I do walking therapy with here and there with a few clients who want it, but mostly people come and see me because they know that the talking is only half the story, that we're going to do body work and touch, and we're going to have the body, as it were, talk in the session through the nervous system, through touch. So that's just a particular specialism of mine. But it's possible to engage the body in movement, in outdoors, and all sorts of wonderful ways to do therapy. And listen, just going for a walk with a friend. And wasn't it interesting that Glenn mentioned that, you know, really in the construction industry particularly and in farming, there's an enormous pressure on the fellas to be strong and robust and to take the mickey out of each other and to be able to handle it. It's a very tough environment because, frankly, the work is very tough. It's a kind of a survival strategy, I suspect. I'm no expert on construction sites. Closest I ever got to a construction site was reading about constructivist philosophy and psychology. But you know, the Stoic methodology of kind of getting on and, you know, being strong and managing yourself in a way that is kind of stable and secure. The strong man image is the Stoic image. And this has its place. But when you're struggling with your life, it's not at all useful to be Stoic. And, you know, in farming and in construction and many other walks of life that I haven't mentioned here, there's a real pressure on the fellas to be strong, to do the work, to step up, and to not make a great fuss. And where does all of that lead? Well, almost inevitably, it leads to alcohol. Because if we can't talk about stuff, if we can't share with each other what is going on for us, then we have this buildup, this overwhelming buildup of energy, of stress and upset and anxiety and trauma. That buildup needs to be discharged. It's really very simple. And of course, one of the easiest ways to do that is to walk into the off-license and buy the alcohol. And there'll be plenty of people to support you in that non-solution to the problem. Of course, all the alcohol will do is give you another problem to focus on, so you don't have to deal with the real issues that are going on for you. The other thing that was interesting was how Glenn talked about how stepping up and stepping into a new role for himself, speaking out, dealing with politicians, dealing with organizations, traveling around, a whole new significance and level of importance of his work, how that was actually triggering him. Because there's something about the way we live our lives that wants to keep things just as they are. Thank you very much. And as we progress and we put more pressure on ourselves, then sometimes the old patterns come out and they do battle with us. And again, this is not by force that we are going to deal with these things, but by understanding what our history is and what messages we got about being successful. And if you're listening and you've found yourself frustrated by not being able to achieve the success you want, then I would bet a fair amount of money, if I was a gambling man, which I'm not, but I would bet a fair amount of money that what you're up against is something inside of you, not external situations or even external solutions. The answer, of course, lies by reflecting within. And that should always be done with someone else. Find a group, join a group, and meet with friends, and find friends that are comfortable talking about themselves. And it was really interesting, wasn't it, how Glenn found that the peer support group that was meeting locally for him was really lovely because it was relaxed, there was no pressure to talk. And hearing other people talk about their issues is actually very, very soothing to know we're not the only ones that are struggling. He talked about mates in construction. If you're in the construction industry, great place to reach out. He talked about Blueprint for Learning. And he also talked about how it was a sign of great management and responsibility to actually reach out for help and to admit that there's something going on that's not right. And for the fellas, of course, the people who know most about whether something's not right is their partners, their wives, their close friends. So have a listen to them. Don't just ignore what they're saying. They're out to monitor and to take care of you. We all are in communities and we need each other to monitor each other. For example, I know that the Inuit, the habit of, you know, touching noses is also a reminder that there might be some frostbite occurring in the only bit that's exposed in very Arctic conditions. We need each other to look after each other and to look after ourselves. It's not a solitary business. And the other thing that I found interesting, particularly in relation to New Zealand, is how many of us or how many of our ancestors came here to get away from something, to leave the past behind. If you came over here in your lifetime, then I wonder if you came here to escape anything. And the trouble is, the shadow of our past is coming with us. If we take our shadow with us, there's that beautiful scene, isn't there, in Peter Pan, where he's trying to stick his shadow back on. I'm not going to read too much into that, but he needed Wendy to sew his shadow back on. Well, I think a lot of people are quite keen to get rid of the shadow. On the other hand, the shadow is a part of our life. It's who we are. And we need to examine that shadow. Sometimes in our lives, we just need to, as it were, spend a few years. And actually, once we start that journey, we realize how important it is. When children go to school, they need to be taught above all else that they need to talk and share and help each other with their issues and their problems, with their shadows. And if you're not sure about how to respond or talk to someone who's struggling, then the simple answer for that is start working on yourself. Explore your own stuff. Because once you start doing that, you'll find it very, very easy to help others. You cannot learn a technique to help other people when they're in some form of distress. You have to, as it were, access and locate your own carried distress. And when you learn how to deal with yourself, it becomes much easier to deal with others. And it's no accident, is it, that this week I've had a session with a man who's doing enormous amounts to help other men. And last week we had Stacey Taylor, who also, from his own journey, is now helping many, many men. And there you have it, right there. By going into our own self, by exploring what makes us tick, what gets us out of bed, what is it that's important to us? By exploring these things, we are able to help others more and more. There isn't really, I believe, a technique to helping people. There's only understanding what it's like to deal with your own pain. And then you start to see and understand how to help others. But it's time now to invite Glenn Thurston back into the psychotherapist chair, in fact, to share his Music with Meaning, which is the third segment of my show. So to get us in the mood for exploring our lives through music, and by the way, I do hope some of you have clocked that by looking through different periods of your life with music, it can be profoundly uplifting and reconnecting and profoundly healing, actually. So write into me if you're finding that you're doing this now and looking at your life and periods of your life through significant pieces of music. I'd love to know how you get on. So far, I've interviewed 30 people now, and every single one of them has said it was a really lovely experience. So take a tip. And to get us in the groove, to get us in the mood for listening to the music and maybe moving to the music and releasing and dancing to the music, let's bring in the fabulous Doobie Brothers with the iconic track, Listen to the Music.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.